it's That's the Thing, the film podcast where twin critics talk about, well, what else? Films. I am your co-host, Nick Cooey, joined as always by my partner in crime, as part of this band apart, Alex Cooey. Alex, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good, you know, a little breathless right now, but I'm doing fine overall. It's been a hot minute since we've done one of these.
Yes, so we decided to record something for the weekend. I'm running out of Godard titles. I mean, in case you haven't been able to guess, today's episode, after a very long hiatus where we weren't producing any podcast episodes, I actually sent Alex a text message the other day upon hearing, well, we've had a slew of high profile celebrity deaths, you know, from Henry Silva to Queen Elizabeth II. But the one that kind of stuck out to me in the last week and a half, 2 weeks was the Nouvelle Vague pioneer and icon Jean-Luc Godard. And I sent Alex a text message saying, Alex, we should do an episode about Jean-Luc Godard. And as soon as I sent him that message, I thought to myself, oh, fuck.
Well, as soon as you said that, my initial thoughts were, absolutely, we should. But then my second thoughts after that were, well, how do we do this?
Yeah, because, well, and the reason we were thinking about that, you know, because there is so much that has been written and discussed about Godard, the man and his work and his legacy, his place in not just French cinema history, but just cinema history in general. I mean, I think that there's a very compelling argument to be made that he is the most influential filmmaker of the second half of the 20th century. You know, there, an entire generation of filmmakers were politically or formally or narratively shaped by his work. And in a lot of ways, this is a comparison that has been brought up time and again, and it's in a comparison that Jean-Luc Godard welcomed very openly in his lifetime. It's a comparison to the musician Bob Dylan. And I think in a lot of respects, that comparison is quite apt, because like Bob Dylan, Godard was someone who came onto the scene in the 1960s, in many respects, completely blew open the doors of what their cultural medium was going to provide for a popular audience. And it was, their work was actually for a brief moment, not only just like popular, but was one of the most dominant forms of pop culture in the 60s. You know, I mean, this is again somebody who was courted openly by Hollywood to make, with his partner in the Nouvelle Vague, François Truffaut, they were approached to make Bonnie and Clyde, which I can't help but wonder what that version, instead of the Arthur Penn 1967 classic that we got, I wonder what Godard and Truffaut's Bonnie and Clyde would have looked like. But I think we've got a kind of a sense of what Godard would have done with Bonnie and Clyde in some of his other movies.
Well, yeah, I think so too. And, you know, because like when he started onto the scene with like Breathless and some of his other movies, he was like, I think, a filmmaker who was inspired very much by film noir and by the crime genre. And the Dylan comparison that you made, I think, is completely apt because of how they were both men. They're both men of the 60s who kind of changed the medium of their respective works. Like Dylan changed music in the ways that people argue that Godard did with cinema. And yet also as people, they're considered kind of like callous and prickly, you know, to put it generously.
Yes, they're private personas. There have been a few stories about both men being perhaps not the most congenial people to work with. But we'll get to that a little bit. I mean, because there's so much that we can and we will try to talk about and in this episode. And I was, from my thinking for this particular episode, was that we were going to just have it be in the tradition of Godard. Not something that's completely improvisatory, but it is very spontaneous and off the cuff. You know, because he was a filmmaker who contained a lot of paradoxes. And one of his paradoxes was that he was one of the most intellectually rigorous people working in cinema to walk the earth. And that was true until his death, you know. I mean, his last film, The Image Book, which I saw in Cannes 4 years ago, which I didn't know would be his last film, it was in many respects, a quintessential late period Jean-Luc Godard video essay. And the amount of not just filmic references, but literary texts, and even him broadening out his scope outside of the constraints of a hegemonic Western narrative to encompass narratives stemming from the Middle East, you know, spoke to an insatiable and voracious appetite for questioning and expanding the constraints of storytelling and who is telling stories and where stories originate and what the politics of storytelling are. I mean, I'm not sure if that's kind of what your experience with Godard was, Alex, if that was something that was apparent to you, or what were some of your first impressions first coming to the cinema and the films of Jean-Luc Godard?
I mean, that's a good question, because I know I sort of came into Godard initially a little after you, and I had heard about him for years, though I was a little reluctant to visit him at first because I was watching a lot of other directors, too, I wanted to follow up their work on. But when I think the introduction of how I got to see him, I maybe will save later. But when I saw him, the impression I got from him, and that is always...
From the man or from the films?
From his films. But I think it also ties into the man himself. Mm-hmm. And what has been constant for me is that he is, like, in his very own intellectual way, he is talking about a rich plethora of, like, all the topics that you're discussing, as well as language and syntax, you know, cinematic language and cultural languages and history. But what he would do is, like, he would maybe twist it around and change their meaning. So trying to explore, analyze, like, what does it mean to say this kind of thing? What does it mean to present something in that particular way? Maybe through visual image or sound. And maybe if they're non-synchronous, the effect it gives on the audience. And the short of it is that he, for me, was like, in his own intellectual way, he was like a guy who viewed cinema, I believe, as like a toy that he could play around with. And he just found infinite possibilities in playing with this toy.
Well, right. I mean, I think that that's not a bad comparison. I think that he certainly viewed cinema as a toy box for him to experiment with constantly, and he did that from the very beginning with Breathless. You brought up Bout de Souffle, and that was actually the first of his films I saw, and that was when I first saw Breathless, God, like 12 years ago, and that was when that was sort of my period of like getting into Criterion's catalog, and I was sort of trying to catch up a little bit on the French New Wave, because I had never seen really anything, and I was very curious to see Breathless, because I'd heard so much about it, that it was a classic, and I saw it, and I hated it. I really went around thinking to myself for about a couple of years, like, wow, this is pretentious drivel, which is certainly, I haven't revisited the film since then, and I would like to go back to it, especially after your compelling article that you wrote on Kiwi Films for the film's 60th anniversary, where you had a much more positive, it seems to me, reception to the film than I did.
Well, I think that was also because, because Breathless was not the first Godard film I'd seen, but, like, I was aware of Breathless and of him, like, when going to film school, as I mentioned. And, of course, they talked about things like his infamous usage of jump cuts. But then when hearing from you, you know, that you saw it, I was like, oh, what do you think of it? And you're like, oh, this is garbage. This is pretentious. You know, it's just crap. And I was like, oh, okay, maybe this is overrated. But it wasn't until my first Godard experience was actually I took you to, because I know you also saw a couple of other stuff like Pierre Le Fou.
Yeah, I had seen, in the interim, then I was like, okay, I'm going to give some of his other work another shot. And I think the other Godard that I saw was Pierrot Le Fou, which I actually really quite like a lot. Pierrot Le Fou for me was, you know, sort of a riff again on Breathless, but coming from somebody who had a much firmer grasp of their medium, who's more sure of themselves and much more confident in the way that they dispensed with their intellectual and political rigor. And you know, we're talking a little bit about Godard's anarchic sensibilities mixed with his intellectual rigor. And I think that part of that, you know, people have debated, you know, is that rigor, is that sort of that anarchism or that sort of that mischievous quality to his work, that fluid malleability, is that rooted in sort of a political desire to break free of constraints? Because he was a filmmaker who constantly talked about freedom, you know, and he was, I think, exploring the many facets of freedom, in terms of a personal question of freedom, in terms of societal freedom, freedom as an act of creative expression through filmmaking. And I think that part of that yearning for freedom, one can debate whether that was rooted in a political conviction. Another can debate if that was rooted in some sort of insouciant obstinance. And I think, personally, for me, it was both. I think the man was constantly looking to challenge the conventions and constraints of the status quo. And that was a consistent, you know, quality of his character even before he was a filmmaker, when he was a critic at Cahiers du Cinéma, you know, and he and a lot of his colleagues, you know, who became filmmakers like Claude Chabrol, Jacques Rivette, François Truffaut, Eric Rohmer, they were criticizing sort of the French tradition of quality, you know, which was sort of this, in their view, a staid and stale form of filmmaking. You know, they weren't interested in the popular French cinema of that time, but they did gravitate towards the American auteurs, you know, or auteurs that were working in Hollywood that now we take for granted, you know, our beloved figures, like someone like Alfred Hitchcock, who it's hard to still conceive, but when Godard and Truffaut were writing for Cahiers du Cinéma, you know, Hitchcock was not considered a superb filmmaker. He was just a showman. And those guys were really instrumental in terms of turning the critical tide to help, I mean, under the stewardship of André Bazin, you know, at Cahiers du Cinéma, of turning the tide in terms of reconfiguring the way we conceived, you know, the auteur theory. And the auteur theory itself is so, it's so prevalent in terms of how we think about filmmaking as well, you know, that it's easy to take for granted, I think, just how much these guys were, and Godard, you know, in particular, was for helping us kind of reconceptualize that sort of idea. I mean, that was a long kind of preamble, but I hope that made some sense.
Oh, no, it made perfect sense to me. I'm sure it made perfect sense to our listeners. But though, of course, Godard's
not... It wouldn't be a Godard episode if everything made perfect sense.
No. but no, you're absolutely right about, like, how, you know, it was their influence that kind of helped, you know, people reevaluate the merit of Hitchcock as an auteur. You're right, especially because, like, around that Hollywood time period, even before the French New Wave, like, of course, where, like, lots of, you know, Hollywood productions, like, the biggest name that would be on the marquee was, aside from the cast members, would be the producer, not mm-hmm. the director. Mm-hmm. And, you know, of course, then that would change over time, and I think that's in no small part thanks to them.
Well, right, and they were very, and it's not even just Hitchcock, you know, who now we look at like as, oh, of course, you know, he's an auteur. Like, there's the Hitchcock film, but even looking at somebody like, I mean, in Godard's example, for example, he was really instrumental in elevating the name of someone like Nicholas Ray, you know, who in the 50s was making Rebel Without a Cause, Johnny Guitar, Bigger Than Life, you know, all these films that had a profound impact on Godard. And like you said, like, some of that could have been because of his own exposure to noir and crime films, and that's something that is evident in Breathless. But it's also, I think, it's speaking to a tendency that's this sort of wounded, angry romanticism that actually extends even further before cinema, like down to to somebody like, for example, Arthur Rimbaud, you know, in his poetry. And Rimbaud is somebody who also influenced so much of French culture, like with Léos Carax's filmography later on, you know. And Léos Carax himself was later on, when he came onto the scene, was compared to Godard in his own inimitable way. But I think that someone like Léos Carax and Jean-Luc Godard are, I think that they certainly can be compared, but I think that they're also extremely different filmmakers in terms of their sensibilities, if not their output.
Well, it's like comparing Godard to Hitchcock and the fact that, yes, both filmmakers did play with their audiences, but they just play with them in their own very unique, different ways. Mm-hmm. And I like that you were comparing even, you know, back to before cinema, because actually when Godard was growing up, he wasn't a guy who necessarily was a frequent cinema goer.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah, he was born in 1930. To actually quite affluent parents, which was interesting considering the turn that he later on took, like in his late 30s when he became radicalized and, you know, an avid vocal proponent for the working class in French culture. I mean, that's something that we touched upon when we were doing our May 1968 episode a couple years ago. But he was somebody who, you know, was a voracious consumer of culture, and particularly of literature, and, you know, and you see in all of his films that he constantly inserts, sometimes subtly, sometimes overtly, references to Proust, Balzac, Rimbaud, and then sometimes even just, but he wouldn't limit himself to just capital L literature, the quality of French literature. What made Godard so compelling, I think, for people in the late 50s and early 60s coming to his work was the way that he melded high art and low art. So he would take Pulp Fiction and crime novels and meld that alongside a rich literary and cultural history and throw that in a blender and provide a sort of postmodern cocktail.
I mean, and that's what's so fascinating. And I think one of the great benefits, I think, of like having his work released on Criterion is like, I don't know about you, but usually like after I watch one of his movies, then I watch the special features on the Criterion for like contextualization and like for references, because then there's so much references he throws in that some are like blatant or obvious. Like in Pierre Le Fou, you have the two main characters like dress up in caricatures of Uncle Sam and Ho Chi Minh. Mm-hmm. But then there are other like more subtle or kind of obscure figures that maybe were prevalent in the time, but people may not be familiar with. But it is fascinating to see like which figures that he does reference and how he references them, like whether by name of figure or even like when he has a character quote a line or a character is named after said figure.
Right. And he was well. And the thing is, what was, I think, really remarkable about Jean-Luc Godard is that he was, it's not that he was just making, when we talk about references and we think about, especially now in the year 2022, postmodernism is sort of the order of the day for popular filmmaking. You know, we think about someone like Quentin Tarantino. We think about Wes Anderson. You know,
we think about Jim Jarmusch.
Yeah, we think about all of these filmmakers who took a page from Godard and, you know, subsume all of these influences and put it in a blender and just like, it's like these jigsaw puzzles. And it's like a guessing game for cinephiles and also like nerds to think about, oh, what is this a reference to? What's this sampled from? But Godard was somebody who, rather than doing that for the sake of pastiche, you know, he was also somebody who was constantly and actively and persistently speaking to the present moment. He was always like, even though he would consistently draw from his past, like culturally, in a literary sense and in a cinematic sense, he was always trying to speak to the present moment. And it got him in some hot water, you know, right from, you know, his second film, Le Petit Soldat, you know, was withheld by the French censors, you know, for about 3 years because of the way it was very strongly condemning France's role in repressing the Algerian independence movement.
Right, right. And also, and it wouldn't be the only time that he would get in trouble with censors. Like, even he made a TV movie called Le Gai Savoir, The Joy of Learning, that he produced for French television, but it was eventually not aired on television, and eventually it was just banned from France altogether.
Mm-hmm. And at that point, I mean, that was, what, 1968?
1969.
69. So at that point, you know, that was definitely when Godard, I mean, you know, and this is somebody who made, gosh, how many movies did he make in the 60s again?
I mean, yeah, like certainly over a dozen.
Yeah. I mean, this, his output was prolific, and it's insane that he would make sometimes two, maybe even three movies a year. I mean, and he worked, that was something that he learned from working on Breathless, you know, of just setting a very small, a shoestring budget, short shooting schedule, and just moving rapidly. And he was someone who could just move rapidly. And he was constantly working. He felt the need to just constantly work. And you can chart this really interesting transition point, you know, in that decade from somebody who has an awareness and an interest in politics to then by 68, 69, someone who is actively and very vociferously rejecting popular cinema, you know, somebody who is even, and then he ended up famously with Jean-Pierre Grand and some other filmmakers forming the Ziegler-Vertov group and trying to sort of reconceptualize filmmaking and shifted away from the auteur theory that he helped popularize, trying to think about, like, okay, what's a film, a form of filmmaking that we can pioneer that actually is in solidarity with the working class?
Yeah, and it's like, I think as he put it, like, he said, like, trying to politically make films or make films in a political fashion. That was the goal that he's trying to do with this group, even though it kind of ended up, like, they didn't make a lot of movies together and sort of fell apart, you know, and I think he became disenchanted with the Maoist ideals at the end, and then, of course, you know, his wife at the time had left him, and he actually attempted suicide on a couple of occasions as a fallout.
Well, right. Well, he had been married, when you say his wife had left him, was that Anna Karina, or was this his
No, that was his second wife, I believe, Anna Wiazemski.
Oh, Anna Wiazemski, yeah. She, who famously, of course, and Godard's whole, his loves in his life were inextricable from the way that, you know, his partners, his spouses, were immortalized by cinema. Because, of course, Wiazemski, he had seen in Robert Bresson's Auguste Balthazar. And he cast her in several of his movies. And Anna Karina, he saw her in a commercial in 1959. And he wanted her to be in Breathless. And she ended up choosing to not be in that film because the scene in question called for her to undress. But then she was in Le Petit Soldat, and they worked on, I believe, 6 films together. They worked pretty consistently from the early 60s up through 1966. And a lot of the films that they made together are some of Godard's most beloved films. You know, I mean, we have Vivre sa vie, we have Pierrot le Fou.
We have Made in USA, we have
Band Apart.
Yeah, a woman is a woman.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the thing is, like, and what's so interesting for me as well, like, watching those movies, that all of them, you know, they are constantly speaking to the present moment, not only politically and culturally, but personally, but in a very oblique way. And this is something that I didn't even realize, but when, you know, the second film that Godard and Karina had made together, Vivre sa vie, by that point, they were married. And she was pregnant with their child, and unfortunately she suffered a miscarriage, and she was not able to, and that, I think, had a tragic impact on the couple. And so you can sense this in Vivre sa vie, which is about a woman who turns to prostitution. It has this elegiac tone to it, you know? I mean, there's no real explicit mention of the loss of a child in that film. But, you know, but knowing that this was having some sort of an impact on that marriage, it's impossible to not read some sort of, to not apply a personal reading to that film. And for me, the genius of watching some of those collaborations that Karina and Godard had was the way that they were able to harmoniously, if not always pleasantly, sort of converge the personal with the broader, the more holistic vision of what was going on in popular culture at that time. That they were a conscious duo within a larger unfolding schema of history, which, and of course it was the 1960s, which was an extremely important era in the 20th century.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I know that a lot of people compare, like, the works that they made together, it's like they compare that to the works that Ingmar Bergman made with Liv Ullmann. But, you know, and what's interesting, I find it interesting that you single out Vivre sa vie, because I also just saw another film that was kind of compared to that, though kind of different, called Every Man for Himself, which he made in 1980. It does not feature Karine, but it is also about prostitution. It is about relationships.
And that was his second first film, I think he called it.
Yes, that is what he called it. He released it in 1980 after he kind of, and it's like he was going back away from his more political stuff to trying to make a little more narrative features. But what I feel is constant from, like, a lot of his movies that I've seen, and what's certainly present, I think, in Every Man for Himself and in a lot of the films I've seen of his, is even though, like you said, he was never overtly autobiographical or never tried to portray too much of himself into a movie, any of his works, though actually Every Man for Himself, like, his main character's name is Paul Godard.
But so he definitely, you know, he didn't make himself the central focus, but he definitely inserted himself.
And he certainly would certainly have a starring role in a few of his films, but
right. And then we look at the video essay films, you know, like Histoire du Cinéma, and then his last two. You know, it's just like he is the dominating force. He's the narrator. He's the one who's guiding us. And even I'm thinking about the Image book, you know, there's a moment that's actually really quite affecting where we hear Godard break out into this raspy cough, and that's signaling his mortality. And of course he was incredibly aware of his mortality, and in that respect I think it's actually really quite poignant that he chose to end his life when he did. He chose to go out on his terms.
Yeah, like, and that's kind of like, he did everything his way, from like how he decided to edit and make his movies to the way he decided when he wanted to end, how he wanted to end his life. You're right. But like, in a lot of his movies, what I think they have in common too is a recurring theme I see, even though, of course, when we think of themes, like we think of like something from a narrative motivation, and he wasn't a guy who was necessarily always driven by story, but I always find it interesting to see like how there's a lot of his movies feature like the contentious relationships between men and women, mm-hmm. and like and how like sometimes usually it's like it's non-harmonious, it's usually very chaotic. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was there from the beginning, like with Breathless, of course, with Gene Seberg playing this kind of like femme fatale of sorts, but then like of course how it's talking about like relationships sort of falling apart, or even like marriages, like Contempt, which he made in the 60s, it was this, a CinemaScope feature with Brigitte Bardot that was about like a marriage that was falling apart while a writer's making an adaptation of the Odyssey for his wife, the leading lady Bardot, and the director Fritz Lang.
Right. And I mean, well, and that, and of course, Contempt or Le Mépris was very famously made when his marriage with Carina was falling apart. And at this point, Godard, you know, famously would sort of tell Carina that, oh, he'd be going out for cigarettes and he'd be gone for 3 weeks and no one knew where he went, and then he'd come back and he would sometimes kind of give her gifts as sort of a form of apology, but she would only know then where he had been, you know, by judging by the gifts that he gave her. So for example, she would see, oh, this tag is from Japan, so he flew out to Japan for 3 weeks without telling anybody. And that comes back to this question of freedom. You know, he has personal freedom, but then that's beginning to sort of run into it's beginning to form a schism with responsibility towards those closest in his life. And this is not the only instance of him betraying the personal confidence of those closest to him. I mean, there's one particular story I think maybe you should tell this, because it's a good one, and it's one probably people know anyway, but it's worth telling.
Yeah, there are a couple of very famous stories, but one in particular is like, it is a famous story I remember you told me about, and it was actually with his colleague and friend Francois Truffaut. And it was like, I remember the story, as I recall hearing about, it's like they sort of had a fallout after Truffaut made the movie Day for Night, which, if you haven't seen it, it was Truffaut's film about like a film crew that's making a movie. And so Godard saw it and he hated it. He like was criticizing Truffaut for making something that was false, you know, it wasn't true to like the filmmaking process, and like, yeah, just called it shit. And then afterwards he asked him for some cash in advance for a project he was trying to work on.
Right. And that, I mean, I don't know if he called it necessarily shit, but he did say it was essentially disingenuous, which, you know, is still rather, for somebody who you came up with and who themselves was a cinephile, like, it's a little hurtful. And then asking for money because Godard asked for money because he's like, oh, because your film will be a commercial success, then you can give me money for my next venture, you know. That understandably rubbed Truffaut the wrong way, and the two men never reconciled.
No, there was actually an interview I saw then, I think it was in 1980, about the time Every Man for Himself was coming out, and he said, like, was asked about if he had seen any of Truffaut's latest stuff, and he basically said how he felt like their styles had differed so greatly from each other that he wasn't recognizable to him anymore.
Right.
But he wasn't like the only person that, only colleague from the French New Wave that he also heard, because there's also the famous stories too about like with Agnes Varda, which was of course portrayed in her penultimate film, Faces Places, with J.R.
Right. And that was, and so, yeah, there's a very famous scene where she and J.R. are trying to go visit Jean-Luc Godard, and he brushes them off in a fairly callous way. And it's disappointing, you know, for Varda, and it's disappointing for us as the audience. It's an anticlimax because we, you know, I mean, neither of us had any sort of personal connection to Jean-Luc Godard, you know, but there is this anticipation that, you know, hopefully there can be some sort of reconciliation, but Godard was a very prickly, iconoclastic individual, and he would hold a grudge, and it sounded like that he just did not make amends with quite a few people in his lifetime. And in that respect, there is like this element of caution that I have in sort of embracing the auteurist image of Godard, you know, because Godard is one of those filmmakers who has been so emblematic within the popular imagination of the Nouvelle Vague that it's also like Dylan, you know, Bob Dylan was bringing it back to Dylan, like Dylan very famously treated Joan Baez in a very abhorrent way. And he was very callous to a lot of his peers. And then Joan Baez famously wrote a song about that breakup. And, you know, and he ended up, actually, Dylan really liked that song. And it's just bizarre, you know, that, you know, that have that disconnect. But regardless of one's personal belief, you know, I think that there is this also, you know, Godard was also belonging to a masculinist tradition in terms of the sense of entitlement that a male filmmaker had in portraying a female subject and the female body. And I think that, and he was also conscious about the commodification of bodies. You know, that was something that, you know, as his work progressed in the 60s, he was constantly talking about capitalism and how capitalism commodified relationships and bodies and our perception of one another within and outside of cinema.
Yeah, I mean, like, by the time he was making Every Man for Himself, and this is why I said it was, like, an interesting comparison, interesting that you brought up Vive la Vie, because that film also is not just about a breakup, but then also it portrays and explores prostitution in that film, too. Like, Isabelle Huppert is a prostitute, and her sister asks her for, like, some advice on how she can get into the business, too. And it's like how Godard famously sort of equated prostitution with filmmaking.
Well, and that's actually really telling, too, because I think Godard was somebody who struggled, you know, in the second half of his life with this question of what the function of filmmaking was. And he was somebody who I think did despair in, I mean, famously in Histoire du Cinéma, you know, his argument is that cinema's potential was squandered because of the Holocaust. Like, because, you know, following the Holocaust, cinema was not able to cause people to just fundamentally change their own perception of committing human atrocities, that cinema itself, like, it failed. And, you know, it's so interesting. You know, I was once, you know, I had interviewed Radu Yud last fall for his movie Bad Luck Banging. And I was asking him sort of a question about this, you know, talking about, like, oh, what are your conceptions of a political cinema and one that's speaking to the current moment? And, you know, and he was just saying, well, I think we give cinema, we expect too much of cinema. And I think that that's a fair assessment in terms of the limitations of the medium. And I think Godard really struggled with, as somebody who was constantly pushing at the limitations of his medium, I think he struggled with, you know, reconciling his ambitions, his intellect with sort of the societal change that he could enact, you know, as an individual or as part of a collective, you know. And I think that part of that could also be attributed to his own shortcomings in perpetuating these, these ideals, you know, that favor the patriarchal auteur, you know, rather than an equal collaboration between men and women. I mean, you were telling me right before we recorded this podcast that Juliette Binoche was, you know, had to audition for a role of his in one of his films, you know, by undressing and then reciting poetry.
Yeah, while combing her hair.
Right. So, I mean, so that's like, he's completely aestheticizing her, you know, for an audition. And I'm not saying that that's not, that, you know, that can't be implemented, or like that, you know, I'm not going to take the Roger Ebert route and then say, well, Juliette Binoche then had no say in, you know, what she was doing, like he did with Isabella Rossellini in Blue Velvet. But I do think that, you know, that, and this is something that's been written about a lot, that the Nouvelle Vague was also very famously, for such a groundbreaking movement, it did fall prey to a fairly sexist attitude about women. I mean, the only woman filmmaker was Agnès Varda.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just interesting to think about, too, like, with Varda being the only female French director of the Nouvelle Vague and like the kind of work she was making around that time, how that contrasts with some of these directors like Vagabond, and how that contrasts with what Godard was making around that time, like with Hail Mary or Every Man for Himself.
Right, right. And Varda's movies, you know, are a lot easier to gravitate toward. As a viewer, I've always felt like Varda is a much more inviting, even though it's a movie like Vagabond is quite grim, but there's something about her work that is, she always held, I think the root of her politics was based in people, in faces, in communities, and really letting the subjects of her film dominate what course her films would take, documentary or non-documentary, you know, and that would blur the line between reality and fiction. And Godard also blurred the line between reality and fiction, but I think he was more motivated by ideas, and he was more motivated by these intellectual precepts and conceptions of what the responsibility was as a storyteller in terms of making one alert, you know. And I mean, and he was constantly employing Brechtian devices in his films, you know, in terms of not making an audience complacent, you know. And that sort of reactionary form of filmmaking is not always easy to sit with. And I mean, it does make his films deliberately so confounding and frustrating.
Well, you know, the way I like to describe watching a Godard film to people is like, it's like feeling your brain being twisted around into a pretzel by the end. That's how I describe one of his features. But that reactionary experience that you describe, it makes me think about the first time I saw a Godard film. And that was actually at the Walker Art Center. It was Au Revoir au Langage.
And we saw this in 3D. It was famously Godard's... Was Film Socialism in 3D?
I can't remember. I thought... I don't know if it was converted to 3D, but like I don't think it was officially 3D. I know he made also a 3D short film beforehand.
Okay.
Though I did not see that. It was screened during the International Twin City... Minneapolis-St. Paul International Film Festival.
But Audio Language was like definitely like his big 3D film. Like that was when...
Yeah.
Even though now 3D's kind of like gone out of style again, like people have to remember, like, you know, since James Cameron's Avatar, and even a little bit before that, like 3D was kind of making a big comeback, and all these filmmakers were like, you know, doing big studio films for 3D, and then of course Jean-Luc Godard's like, okay, I'm gonna make a 3D movie.
Well, yeah, and then you have these also more independent directors like Wim Wenders with his documentary Peanuts. So yeah, now Godard was giving a try at it, and I heard about it first through Cannes, but then I saw it was screening, I think this was like a year after its Cannes premiere. And then I saw a screening at The Walker, and I just thought, well, you know, it'd be interesting to probably see what he does with 3D. And I said to you, like, hey, you want to go see this with me? And I think you were kind of like, all right. So we went to see it, and considering it was my first Godard feature, I don't think I was fully prepared for, like, and because, yeah, it certainly was less narratively driven than some of his 60s features or even his 80s features. So it's like we couldn't really make heads or tails of what was going on while watching the film.
And
I mean, of course, and I think who recognize now, but now I'm more familiar, so I can understand like his trademarks of like how he approach and make movies. But I remember, I'll never forget the moment when because there would be times with, you know, wearing in 3D, like he'd have like title cards that look like they appear a little more closer, though not too in your face with the camera. I was like, okay, that's nifty or interesting. But though there was a moment where two people are talking, and it's a famous moment that a lot of people have talked about. It was even, I believe, cheered a con when this happened, but like two people are talking, and then like one on the left side of the frame and one on the right side of the frame. And if you can imagine like a person on the right side of the frame just walking away, just exiting, like going to the right, and then as he's walking further, the image all of a sudden becomes all blurry and twisted, like if you're watching with both eyes. And I remember I sort of like blinked, and I think the way I blinked, one eye was closed before the other, and then I just noticed something briefly. I was like, wait a sec. So then I just switched my eyes around, and I noticed that if I closed my right eye, the entire frame would just consist of the person from the left side of the frame. Mm-hmm. But if I switched my eyes around, I could see where the person on the right side of the frame went to.
Right, right. No, I remember very specifically the scene. It's just and I don't know I can't remember the context of it, because whatever semblance of a story is in Audio Langage is, it's the thinnest of narrative frameworks, but it's just essentially the scene in question is just like, this woman is talking to a priest, and then her partner comes up, angrily pulls her aside, and they're arguing. And on one side of the, like you said, one side of the frame, and while the priest is on the other side of the frame, just reading a book. And I remember you told me, you just leaned over and you whispered into my ear, like, just close one of your eyes. And I was like, because I was also like you, I was like, what the hell is he doing with the image? And then I closed one eye and I closed the other, closed one eye, closed one the other. And it is one of the most remarkable things that's ever happened to me in a theatrical experience. And the thing is, I can't, you know, I'm even just reviewing, you know, there was a wonderful article on Mubi that was published by Ted Fent talking about every single, or trying to like get at every single reference in this movie that Godard inserts, both in terms of literature and cinema, you know. And I'm like, oh yeah, okay, I guess there was Beethoven and Derrida and, you know, Fritz Lang, but fundamentally, you know, as in an experiential sense, the thing that I take away from that film is that moment and having that really send a shockwave into my conception of what a 3D film can do. And it's so simple, and it comes back into this very immediate and childlike sense of invention in terms of thinking about what can you do with this medium to really challenge our conception of what we're looking at and who we're choosing to look at. And to me, that's actually, it's not born necessarily out of a sense of derision for the audience, but actually a generosity in terms of not everyone's going to get it, but those who do catch on to that, you know, it will cause them to sort of break out of their stupor. And, you know, even though they won't quite understand why Godard is doing this, why he's doing what he's doing, but it will, you know, but for me personally, it was actually a very generous moment. And for me, that's Godard at his best, was when he utilized this medium to constantly encourage active spectatorship and not a docile, passive form of consuming cinema.
Yeah, I mean, and that's sort of what I was getting at earlier when I said it was, you know, you say childlike, and that just I think goes back to what I was saying earlier about how it was like the cinema was like his toy box that he was playing with, and this is just his way of experimenting with the form. And it was, for me, it was like, as you know, a young man who's always trying to like absorb and to learn so much from cinema, you know, as I try to tell my own stories, it was so eye-opening and inspiring to see like this guy in his 80s utilize 3D technology in a way I had never seen before or since. And like, especially when like lots of filmmakers like 40, 50 years his junior, you know, aren't even trying to be as audacious or like experimental. No. Or adventurous. And so it's always, you know, even though it's interesting, because I always consider like art to have like endless possibilities, but it's interesting how you say like even still, like even art has its limitations and cinema does as well.
Right. Well, I think it has its, when I say limitations, I mean like its sociological limitations in terms of what cinema can do to impact social change. You know, I think that, you know, I remember once hearing somebody make the remark that there were no good protest songs, because if there were any good protest songs, then the world would have changed. And I think that's one of the dumbest things I've ever heard anybody utter. And I think that that same attitude that's held toward cinema is frankly idiotic, because, you know, to expect something which is inorganic, I mean, the film itself is not organic. What's organic is the relationship between spectator and the film, a spectator and the film that they're watching. And Godard, I think, understood that. I think he came to understand that more and more. And so then he said to himself, okay, I can't change the world, but I can. But I think, you know, whenever somebody has that sort of understanding, then you can choose to do one of two things. One, you can rest on your laurels and become complacent and dissociate from history and from what's going on in terms of global politics and in terms of the world, or you can actively try to push yourself. And he chose the latter path, and that path is not easy, but it's a really commendable path. And I have, even though he's somebody whose prickly persona, you know, can frustrate and disappoint, I do have a tremendous amount of respect for the way that he never, ever gave himself an excuse to just coast. That he was always actively thinking, you know, about this medium that he could not live without. And I think that that's a generous gift for generations to look back on when you watch even his stuff from the 60s, you know, to jolt somebody awake, you know. And I think that it's just one aspect of many, many topics of controversy that will be discussed about Godard for decades to come. I hope will be discussed, because he's a filmmaker who, you know, whose work will stay with us, and it should stay with us.
Wasn't he the last auteur of the Nouvelle Vague to survive?
I think you're... Well, hold on. I think Jean Rouch... Well, it was Jean Rouch part of the Nouvelle Vague? No, he wasn't. But I think he's definitely one of the last. You know, I mean, because we've lost Chabrol, we lost Rivette. Varda died 3 years ago. I mean, and, you know, a lot of Godard's actors, you know, like Carina died in 2019. Last year we lost Jean-Paul Belmondo. So, I mean, there is... I remember talking actually with a few of my buddies in grad school. You know, I was like, one of them was saying, like, man, you know, when Godard dies, like, that's going to be, you know, it's like the passing of a titan. And it's true, I think, in a lot of respects, that, like, somebody who was so monolithic, you know, consciously or unconsciously, the way that he changed filmmaking, you know, it is the passing of this baton. And, and yeah, I mean, I'm sad that he's gone, and I'm sad that we won't be seeing more of his work, but I am grateful that he was working constantly, and he was, you know, never, that he wasn't a complete recluse, you know. I mean, just last year, he had this very famous, like, hour and a half interview on Instagram.
Yeah, I was watching some of that, actually, and it was interesting hearing him talk about, like, the way, like, him talking about, like, the way the news media was covering, talking about COVID. 19, you know, so even at the start, he wasn't necessarily talking about his work in cinema, because I think he wasn't a guy who liked necessarily to be always, like, lathed on with a praise for his work or anything like that. Like, I heard stories about, like, where if somebody was praising him for his work as a director, he just gave them a dirty look. And, of course, famously, like, even for his last movie, The Image Book, he wasn't present at the press conference at Cannes, but he was able to do it through a phone. Like, so just them holding up this phone where he could be on a little screen and answer people, the press's questions.
Right, right.
But, yeah, and I do think, I wrote in my tribute to him on Facebook how I don't know if I would have liked him as a person, but I think this is where, of course, is that endless debate of people talking about if you can separate the artist from the work. But I also feel like, for me, it's like... it's very difficult to, you know, on the, and it's sort of almost a case-by-case basis. But for me, Godard is like one of those directors whose output is so influential and so eye-opening that, you know, it's like to, you know, I just feel very grateful and lucky that we managed to have him, you know, within our lifetime and with the previous generation's lifetime come in to kind of like push the envelope in terms of trying to say, you know, like what we can do with the form of cinema.
And what we can do, and how the form and the politics of movie making are inextricable from one another. And you don't have to necessarily agree with Godard's assertions about the politics of filmmaking, you know, because he often was somebody who was very outspoken, you know, in terms of his views on cultural, on unpopular filmmaking. You know, I mean, he's someone who's constantly criticized Spielberg, you know, in terms of what his films have produced. In terms of the path that they laid for popular culture. And I don't think he's necessarily wrong in that, in his argumentation. But I think that he allows enough room for debate.
My view is right and yours is wrong.
Exactly. It's not oppressive, you know. You know, I mean, it's very authoritative and it's very forceful, but that's the films themselves, and I think, or that's the man, I should say, and the films themselves, while they're very forceful and they have a lot going on in terms of their argumentation, once you're done watching the films, again, like, then we as spectators are left to process what we've just seen. And I've had some really wonderful conversations with people after watching some of Jean-Luc Godard's films. Like, I mean, there was a great series about 4 years ago at the Trilon about films from 1968, you know, kind of about the summer of 68, and one of the films that I was screening there was Les Chinoises, and I reached out to one of my very good friends who's a leftist, but he had never seen anything by Godard, and I said, okay, you should watch one of this guy's movies, and we should watch one of his most overtly political films, and so we went and saw Les Chinoises, and he was just completely at a loss as to what to make of it. But we had a great conversation about it afterwards, and we were kind of thinking about, like, okay, what is the purpose of this Brechtian use of cutting the soundtrack off at these junctures? And, you know, what is he saying about, you know, the responsibility of youths? And is he, like, you know, praising Maoist politics, or is he also satirizing the arrogance of the youth movement in terms of their folly? You know, at one point, how much of this is self-aware, you know? I mean, and so in that respect, his work is actually, again, quite generous in giving us room to think and talk and dream.
And I think you can see a reflection of that generosity in just the amount of filmmakers who were inspired by him. I mean, like, from the 70s, you had, like, Martin Scorsese, of course, being very inspired by him. Even with stuff like Taxi Driver, he takes some very Godard-esque cuts with, like, the way he does editing and with sound cues in that movie,
mm-hmm.
you know. Or, like, of course, Brian De Palma is a director who I think was also inspired, even though he's also inspired by Hitchcock, but he also kind of, like, is one who calls attention to the medium of cinema and how he kind of has fun with it, too.
Right, that Brechtian approach towards, you know, active spectatorship, you know, which, yeah, I mean, it's very, the way that those filmmakers apply that, like, I think that there's something to be said, though, about also, even though they're very, very different from Godard, but I don't think that their work then depoliticizes those devices that Godard was using. I think that, you know, I think something like Taxi Driver and Blowout are extraordinarily political, mm-hmm. you know, in their convictions, but they're very different than how Godard was political.
And some of these filmmakers would make political work soon. Others were just inspired by his approaches and, you know, try to incorporate into their ways of telling the stories. Like, I think of Alejandro González Iñárritu, obviously taking title cards for Birdman,
which I have kind of a problem with.
Yeah, I mean, I love how his latest, I'll just say, I love how his latest movie has gone trashed at Venice, and I'm like, yeah, shocker. But then, like, of course, his friend and colleague Alfonso Cuarón being very inspired by A Band Apart, I feel, when he made Y Tu Mama También.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that whole dance scene at the end of Y Tu Mama También is very much, like, speaking to that the Madison dance scene in Band Apart.
And also the way that he utilizes narration, like when the audio goes silent and then the narrator comes in. That's exactly like how it is in A Band Apart. And also, like, you know, as we mentioned too, like filmmakers like Jim Jarmusch, the way that he would, you know, postmodern, and like the way he would, like, incorporate all these references to famous figures or literature.
Or I love even like a filmmaker like Terrence Davies, who for me is tonally and in terms of temperament is as furthest away as I can think from like Godard's sort of restlessness. Like Davies has this stately elegance, but he was, you know, he's influenced very clearly by Godard as well, you know, and he paid tribute, I mean, alongside all these other filmmakers, you know, who were inspired, you know, by Godard growing up in the 60s. And especially for someone like Terrence Davies, who's somebody who, like, late 1950s, like, has avidly rejected popular culture. You know, he's very much, like, in all of his work, you know, he has this real reticence about incorporating modern music and filmmaking. But so for someone like that to, you know, very openly praise and pay tribute to a filmmaker as modern as Jean-Luc Godard, I think speaks to just the vibrancy and potency of Godard's filmmaking.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like, you know, since we were talking about all the influences and, like, we talk about his work and who Godard was as a director and as a person, you know, I feel like now is a good time to ask, like, though, and everybody was clearly inspired by different, by particular films from him. But I'm just so curious to know, like, which films you would recommend from Godard.
You didn't see this, but Alex very dramatically pointed at me, so I think he's addressing the question to not you. Well, I mean, but the listener, you know, you, dear listener, can take up the question as well in comments, because we would love to hear, you know, as again, someone who's so prolific, you know, what your experiences with Godard are. But for me personally, and this was a really tough question, because, again, like, I was kind of on the fence about, like, oh, Pierrot Le Fou, you know, because I really do like that film a lot, and I think it's fun but vicious, and it's beautiful but garish, and it's constantly playing with these juxtapositions, you know, of being seductive and alluring and at the same time an open screed against this encroaching despair. both societally and personally. And I'm someone who actually does like, I mean, my exposure to, I'll be frank, my exposure to Godard's work mostly lies in his 60s work. There's still a lot of his films that I have yet to see. And some of them are really hard to find, like Nouvelle Vague from 1990. I don't think has ever gotten a video release.
And one film that I want to see, like First Name Carmen, isn't available, even though that won like the Golden Lion at Venice.
Well, good news, actually. This episode is unofficially sponsored by Canopy. If you have a Canopy subscription, you can watch First Name Carmen on Canopy.
Oh, capital.
All you need is a library card. So, yeah, which is great, you know, because I was looking up Godard stuff on Canopy, and I was like, oh my God, there's like Forever Mozart, and there's, you know, yeah, Prénom Carmen, you know. So I was very excited by that. But I will say that, you know, just to kind of, if I had to pick one title of Godard's that I really love, you know, and it's because of just, it's not, I can't even articulate all of what makes it great. But for me, Weekend from
1967,
yeah. For me, that's the late 60s Godard movie I really love, because it is such a vicious, apocalyptic, it's one of the great movies about hell that's ever been made, you know, because it's essentially, and there is a story, it's just about this bourgeois couple that's going on a weekend getaway, and they're just constantly squabbling over earning this sort of potential, you know, fortune, and you know, whatever their financial difficulties are sort of get laid to the wayside as the film progresses. And the whole fabric of everything, the social order, even just the emergence of long dead historical figures like Emily Dickinson, indicates like that reality itself is collapsing. And what Godard is employing a lot of sort of the color schemes, the brash pop art color schemes that he utilized in Made in USA and Pierrot Le Fou. But the difference in something like Weekend is that it feels like he is bringing us to the edge of the abyss, that he is saying that we are on the precipice of some cataclysmic disaster where, and it's in many respects like the most full-throated condemnation of bourgeois capitalism that he had crafted up to that point in his career. And you can feel that, you know, even though he had some anger and he lobbied criticism constantly at the status quo, Weekend is absolutely ferocious in the way that it shows the literal cannibalism that the bourgeoisie indulges in. And he ties that in with also, very famously, the end card is, you know, fin, and then fin du cinéma. So he's also saying that cinema itself is reaching a critical breaking point. And what, you know, as we're looking towards the future, what can we conceptualize, you know, for cinema as a tool in shaping a new world? And there's something very disturbing about them. It's not an easy watch. I mean, none of Godard's films are an easy watch, but in particular, Weekend is it's a vicious film, but it's also one that absolutely does not allow its audience to be complacent. It demands us to have a reaction to colonialist violence, towards classist, insidious, just disparities. I mean, and also our complete disengagement from history, when history is literally coming to intervene on our present moment and force us to reckon with where we've come from and where we need to go. In that respect, it's, I think, absolutely compelling and captivating. And I've only begun to scratch the surface of what the film is trying to do. There's so much that you can talk about. I mean, with any of his films, you could dedicate a whole episode to a movie like Weekend. But in terms of movies that I love of his work, like, that's the one I would say, like, that will jolt somebody awake, or should jolt somebody awake.
Weekend, I must confess, is one of the films I've not seen of his, and I think I've seen, like, I've counted, like, maybe 16 of his movies, and I also saw a TV special he did, and I know he's made, like, over 70, so yeah. It's a lot of stuff, but, like, I know that also Weekend, famously, like, you know, it's Fin du Cinéma, also was a film, I believe he thought he was going to retire afterwards, like, he had famously told his cast and crew, like, you better start looking for work elsewhere. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's like not just the end of cinema, but of his cinema. And right. But of course, then he directed himself towards more political, as we have mentioned previously. Mm-hmm. In terms of like stuff that I would recommend, I think the Godard film I would recommend to most people to check out, that's the most accessible of all his stuff, is A Band Apart,
which he called one of his worst films.
Well, you know, it's funny because Tarantino actually said he didn't care for Weekend. So like he was introduced to Godard. He first came to introduce him through a marathon, and like he got so, like stuff through the 60s. He got so involved by that by the end of Weekend, he was like, eh, I don't care about Weekend. But so,
well, it's, well, Godard had his own thoughts on Tarantino, yeah, very famously.
Mm, right, yes. But but I you know, he may have called his worst film one of his worst, but yeah, it may not be as experimental, but I still think it, for me anyways, I recommend A Band Apart still, because I personally felt it doesn't compromise on like some of his themes and his ideas of like what Godard, his approach was to filmmaking, but it still does in a way that I think could be accessible to an audience, you know, without being compromising on who he was. And also, you know, like, and getting the sense of like the idea, like with the youthful characters and that sort of like spontaneity that they experience and feel, but also like the, and which is also reflected through the filmmaking, through the editing, and through its non-synchronizing sound. And I think it's all those traits which are like, that summarize Godard are present in this movie. Mm-hmm. So, but it's in a way that I think people could still be able to digest more easily than others. Like, certainly digest more easily than Goodbye to Language. Even though if you see it, you know, you should see it in 3D, you know, to see what we talk about. Because one of those things of you need to see to believe.
Right.
But otherwise, I guess also on a personal note, I kind of recommend Breathless, though I don't think it's his best movie. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it is more like an imitator than maybe his later stuff would be. But for me, there is a kind of a playful, you know, what you thought was pretentious at the time you saw it, I thought there was kind of a playfulness of him having fun. Like, here's this up-and-coming guy who's just having a go. And it was very difficult for him to make the movie, from what I heard. It was on a shoestring budget.
He shot in, like, what, 3 to 4 weeks?
Something like that, yeah. And, like, shot with, like, a camera that's used for photography. So, of course, it's like the all the sounds completely dubbed and like not knowing what to, because, and he also never really shot with a script. He'd have like 2 to 3 words for each page, like as he showed on the Dick Cavett show in one time. But I think that was the case too with Breathless. But still, for me, it was kind of like, okay, how can I make this kind of special for myself? What can I do? And I think it was the first time that he kind of was having fun with not just the genre, but also with the different themes, which, all, again, I think would sort of reflect his occupying interests. And for me, it's just kind of like, I think people go back to Breathless now and again because it is kind of like this playful deconstruction and dissection, even though it wasn't as, like, maybe deconstructive or chaotic as maybe his later stuff would be. But still be kind of like, okay, what can I do with the language of cinema, with cultural syntax, you know, and with meaning. What does it mean, like, to say these terms or words? Like, there's a famous thing, famous instance where Jean Seberg almost says to the camera at the end, like, you know, he just called me this, you know, like.
And there's been a lot of debate about exactly the English translation of that word as well. Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, there's so much of that, and there is one moment, and it's something that's actually been brought back up since his Godard's passing. There's a very famous moment where Jean-Pierre Melville pops up, you know, and an interviewer asks him, oh, what's your great ambition? And he famously responds, you know, it's to become immortal and then die. And I remember, like, hearing that line for the first time when I watched the movie. I was like, what the fuck does that mean? Like, this little hotshot 18-year-old, like, being like, oh, God, this guy's... But, you know, I get it. I get it completely. And that's what Godard has done. He became immortal and then he died.
Yeah, he did. Well, I mean, if not in the human flesh, certainly through his body of work. He's become immortal. He belongs to the ages, as they said about another figure who died. I think that applies to him.
Right, right. So, yeah, I mean, there's so much of his work that we could be talking about and we can still dive into. And I will continue to dive into personally for years to come. I just downloaded the complete Histoire du Cinéma, which I've seen like 2 episodes of. And that's great, but man... That is rigorous stuff, and it's like somebody trying to tackle Finnegan's Wake in one go. You know, you just got to allow yourself room to breathe. But I'm really glad that we had some time to talk about a filmmaker who did have such a huge impact on the culture, and you know, it personally made some work that I responded to very strongly. And I'm really glad, Alex, that you agreed to sit down for this episode. I don't think we've offered any sort of authoritative account or a final word on Godard, the filmmaker, or the man, but I don't think any person could. I think the great thing about any artist is that you just generate a relationship with their work and then carry that with you and share that with other people.
Yeah, carry that with you and share with you and in whatever ways you wish to, whether it's through your own movies that you make or like other works of art or even just like your personal beliefs or political beliefs. Yeah, just relationships, just anything.
Or just sitting down and talking for an hour for a podcast.
Yes, exactly.
And on that note, thank you, dear listener, for listening to us chat about movies. As always, be well, stay safe, and continue to watch great movies, a lot of which were directed by Jean-Luc Godard.
Thank you. And remember, we're all in this together. And a bientôt, Monsieur Godard.